1950s baby oil dick so he can army crawl over to the next barely legal plaything fingering herself on his satin sheets. You don't need them. Pose in Playboy if you want, but take the money and buy some real estate and start being your own well of support. When I was 30 years old, I was divorced from my older husband and very lost. But it was the fire I needed to fix myself. I built up my savings, dedicated myself to yoga and therapy, cried in both, and worked on being happy by myself. When I met my second husband at a party, I didn't need a thing from him, just his presence. You don't need an older man to show you the world, to teach you about good food, to help you. You just need yourself. Chapter 12. Let the teens fuck each other. Colleen Merkbach stands stoically in front of the classroom. Draped head to toe in dramatically distressed denim, she holds a beautiful rose in front of her face. The fluorescent lights reflect off her brassy highlights as her weighty mascara fights with her violet-painted eyelids. She's beautiful, in an 80s New Orleans rodeo clown kind of way. Colleen hands the rose to a circle of Jefferson High's finest young women. Each of y'all take one petal, then pass it around, Colleen barks. The women do as instructed, as Colleen half sits on a desk, psychotically twitching her right leg. One by one, the students mutilate the blossom. When the last petal is removed, Colleen snatches the bare, thorny stem. See what happens when you give your sex petals away, ladies? She says. You go from a beautiful virgin flower to a thorny, useless slut stem. Don't be a flower whore. You got it? Meet America's abstinence educators. Colleen is fictional, but she's just like the real ones. Dumb, mean, and possessed by a strange affinity for dramatic props. While they throw their scary stats and misogynist nonsense at the entire student body, they reserve most of their ire and shame for all the young lady sluts in the bleachers. To understand how these psychologically maladjusted adults came to infiltrate our nation's schools, let's take a trip back to the early 2000s. The president, George W. Bush, wasn't the laid-back Renaissance painter everyone knows and loves today. He was, is, a warmonger and the king of a ruined U.S. economy. But that wasn't enough chaos for Mr. Mission Accomplished. Mm-mm. Just for funsies, he ushered in a new era of abstinence-only education. Under his presidency, we got Title 11, Section 1110 of the Social Security Act, which gave federal money to community and faith-based organizations to teach abstinence-only education and leave out any important information about safe sex or contraception. So in other words, federally funded deception. Since its inception, over $2 billion has been spent in this country trying to talk teens out of the funnest activity Jesus ever invented. There's no data on how many abstinence educators suddenly became qualified to teach these federally funded courses, but there seems to be a lot of them. Enough to not just incorrectly screw in a light bulb, but to also shoot our nation's light bulbs to pieces, plunging our country into eternal darkness. And they're all variations of the same confusing combination of women's prison guard, your blowhard divorced uncle, and a Parisian balloon animal artist. Let's meet some of them. Pam Stencil arrives at public schools in her funky jean jacket and Elvis-like swagger, ready to fight evil female sexuality. According to her website, Pam got her start working in pregnancy crisis centers, the Venus flytrap of women's organizations. Women think they're going in for medically accredited abortion help, but what they too often get is a bunch of pro-life propagandists armed with an ultrasound machine and misleading stats to scare them out of abortions. It's medical coercion by anti-choice thugs and the perfect training ground for an abstinence educator. Instead of shaming one woman at a time, Pam can now guilt hundreds in a single afternoon. She likes to stand on a high school auditorium stage, hopefully with the set of the senior production of Little Shop of Horrors still up, and scare lots of young women about sex leading to scarred fallopian tubes. I suppose she's going buck wild with all the potential horrors of untreated sexually transmitted diseases, but I prefer to believe Pam thinks some sort of deformed sharp penis could corkscrew its way through the vagina, into the uterus, and then up into the fallopian tubes. Not surprisingly, in order for her program to be eligible for money, it only has to meet 8 guidelines under another abstinence grant system, Title V of the Welfare Reform Act. And none of them dictate her to include medically accurate information. If it did, Pam couldn't pad her lectures with tidbits about how abortion can lead to anorexia, bulimia, and cutting. Information she might have pulled from a 2009 study by Priscilla Coleman and her colleagues at Bowling Green University, finding that abortions can lead to future mental health issues. A study that was discredited by the University of California's Julia Steinberg and the Guttmacher Institute's Lawrence Feiner because, dumb bitch alert! Priscilla didn't take into account if those women had mental health issues before their abortions. I'm not a boxing fan, but I would buy front row tickets to watch Julia Steinberg eviscerate Priscilla Coleman with knowledge. But like with drag queen rules, so they'd say stuff like, Priscilla, your data collection's so sloppy, cafeterias are serving them between 2 buns and calling it lunch. Ooh, your panties hot? 'Cause you done got burned. The luxury Pam has as an abstinence educator is she really doesn't need to fact check. She can put on her denim bathrobe, pop open her industrial-sized laptop, pull whatever official sound and word bites off the internet, and still have time to watch her favorite episodes of Last Man Standing, which, yeah, she does own on DVD. She probably doesn't even have to search for all her facts, since I'm guessing she can just make them up. According to the Charleston Gazette-Mail, in 2013, a student at a West Virginia high school reported that Pam had told her classmates that if they take birth control, their mom probably hates them. Okay, Pam, what if these ladies, like me, let their significant other pull out and shoot his meat cream all over their back? Where does that fall on this twisted scale, huh? Her advice to boys is simple. If you see a girl dressing in that manner, and you know what I'm talking about, that says to you and every other boy in the country, take me now. A little word of advice, boys. Run! Have you ever wondered what kind of person could be magic spelled into existence if a witch threw a Diet Mr. Pibb, a Spanish teacher haircut, an S&M adjacent statement belt, and a mauve fringe jacket into a cauldron? Wonder no longer! Presenting abstinence super educator Shelley Donahue. Shelley is part of an abstinence until marriage organization called Wait! Why Am I Tempted? Which has gobbled up over $8.2 million in federal funds to make young women feel like trash in public schools, churches, and community centers throughout Colorado. There's a lot of money in abstinence education, and they invest 1 to 2 full dollars packing their sex-shaming presentations with terrible props. Shelley's known in the abstinence world for her amazing tape demonstration that really drives home to men why they shouldn't risk putting their innocent cherub dicks into nasty young women. She's a male volunteer pretend a piece of tape is his new girlfriend and excitedly delivers the joke, "Look, she's very transparent," before instructing him to expose his naked forearm so he and the tape can have sex in front of everyone. Shelley then sticks the tape to his forearm and exclaims, "Look, they bonded!" Like she's a scientist who just discovered the concept of adhesive. She then cruelly makes the boy break up with his cellophane girlfriend, a process similar to a bikini wax, but with less excruciating labial stinging. Using the overdramatic hand gestures of a low-rent David Blaine, she points at the now gnarled tape. "Look at his little hairs," she says. Look at his skin cells and his DNA and his lotion and his cologne and his germs and his sweat. Shelley brings up another volunteer and asks him to get naked on your arm. She tries to stick the tape on, but shocker, it's less sticky. Shelley's fringe jacket jingles as she uses her acrylic nails to gesture to the grizzled piece of tramp tape. She then drives her point home. How many partners do we have before we get married on average in America? She cringes. Six, yeah. So can you imagine what's going to start to happen to this type? It's going to lose its bonding power. Because Shelley is so unwilling to do any hard research to back up her claims, she doesn't know the average number of premarital sexual partners is actually higher. Think of all the sluts she could scare with real facts. According to a 2015 study by San Diego State University psych professor Jean Twenge, the greatest generation averaged 3 sexual partners in their lifetime. Boomers nearly quadrupled that number to 11, and Gen X and millennials reported having had 10 and 8 sexual partners respectively. I've had 24 sexual partners. I know the exact number because I keep a spreadsheet named Guys I've Had Sex With, and that's the truth. It's in my Google Drive, and they're all in there. The Pauls and the Michaels, and some whose names I don't remember, so they're listed as Karate Guy and Rachel's friend with the 80s Steve Jobs glasses. According to Shelley's logic, my pussy tape should be so loose I could effortlessly slide a simple human dual compartment waste bin inside me. Ha 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 ha! Joke's on her. I'm tighter than Sarah Huckabee Sanders' stress-clenched butthole on a Friday afternoon. Not to be outdone in the bold look department is abstinence educator Justin, call me by my real name, Lookadoo, who's putting his own spin on frosted tips, Ed Hardy knockoff button-downs, and distressed jeans. His look says to the world, yes, I am the vanilla ice of Hootie and the Blowfish. Justin wrote a book for teens with the razzle-dazzle title, Dateable, Are You? Are They? Which teaches women that the best way to get to know the man they're dating is to zip their pie holes. He writes, be mysterious! Dateable girls know how to shut up. They don't monopolize the conversation. They don't tell everyone everything about themselves. They save some for later. They listen more than they gab. Silence is not mysterious. You know what's mysterious? Wearing a vampire cloak at all times. Suddenly speaking fluent Flemish. Leaving a restaurant via grappling hook. That's creating mystery. Anyone who wants to go on a date with a mute woman is an incurious narcissist who just wants to fuck you while they look at themselves in their sliding closet mirror, which I am here to tell you is distracting. Justin uses a lot of literary tricks in his book, like poetically referring to women as prey to be hunted by men. Fish taking bait, and uncharted territory to be conquered. If you told me his apartment was stacked floor to ceiling with gothic gold titled medieval fantasy paperbacks, wilted in a way indicating years of jizz-covered hand-holding, my level of shock would be non-existent. When Lookadoo's not teaching young girls how to be docile prey in his advice books, he's lecturing IRL teen girls about how dumb they are. At Richardson High School in Richardson, Texas, senior Aisling Menezes wrote a blog about Justin's speech that went viral. In her telling, Lookadoo told the auditorium, ladies, I'm going to say this in the nicest way possible. You are the most horrible, awful, vindictive creatures this planet has ever seen. What the fuck does women shutting up or being vindictive have to do with not having sex? Nothing. I guess abstinence education is one of the most lucrative career paths for people who hate women. And why do they dress so terribly? Is it part of the abstinence education uniform to suffocate all sexuality with denim? Justin Lookadoo is allowed to harbor whatever long-standing grudge he probably has against some woman for a toothy blowjob he got in 1996. Pam Stencil should be free to stew about her 15-year-old mother giving her up for adoption or whatever chip she has on her shoulder about women and their sexuality. They're all allowed to hate women. But what they're not allowed to do is drown themselves in so much chambray while also taking their irrational emotions out on young women desperate for answers about their sexual health and well-being. We didn't have abstinence education at Cypress Falls High School, but we did have Young Life, an after-school Christian program that, according to their website, is designed to introduce disinterested high school kids to Jesus. They do so by enlisting club leaders with Goo Goo Dolls haircuts who can sell Christianity using their coolness, by casually propping one leg onto a stool and telling horny teens, "Dude, God, like, doesn't want you to, like, have sex, okay, man?" In Jesus' name, cowabunga. The Young Life of West Houston was in a strip mall by I-10 and Beltway 8. It was a scenic stretch of Houston surrounded by concrete supports, highways, and hopelessness. I went to one meeting with a boy named Mason, who I was trying to lure into my vagina, my plan being to gain his trust by pretending to be a sweet virgin, then breaching his trust by sucking his dick under a pine tree. Meetings were held in a rectangular room with zero art, off-white walls, and no chairs. Young Life wants to feel like a dope hang zone, but the vibe was more front for Russian money laundering cartel. The leader, a guy whose name I've forgotten, but safe bet is probably Trey, kicked off the meeting with a transparency projector. He turned off the lights and everyone made a ooh noise, as if anyone in the room was getting laid. Mason was sitting next to me in his Texas uniform, crisp polo shirt, starched khakis, and boots. His eyes were glistening with excitement. What fun was in store for us tonight? Passing around a beach ball? Indoors? Free 7-Up? Side hugs? Oh, no, no, no. It was much better than all that. The light of the projector turned on, displaying the transparency on the wall with the lyrics to Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer. According to John Bon Jovi, the song is about the effects of Reagan-era trickle-down economics on working-class families. But Young Life saw it as pop music bait to hook teens with hardcore Christianity. As if any teens in the late 90s, the Hole and Smashing Pumpkins decade, was going to be like, "What? Christians like decades-old pop hits just like me, a teenager?" Bon Jovi was not cool. It was the music choice of uncles who work out on Bowflexes in open garages while drinking beer. But when Trey pressed play on the CD player, the whole room of virgins belted out the decades-old mega hit off Slippery When Wet, an album clearly referencing what happened to pussies when they came close to John Bon Jovi and his home perm. The double entendre was lost on everyone but me. This was just the kickoff of 2 hours of structured Christian fun. The whole thing was about as inspirational as a dental hygienist showing me how to floss each side of the tooth. During the club meeting I suffered through, Trey's message of the night was about our virginal promise to God and the importance of purity rings, the sterling silver wedding rings teens wear to let everyone know their genitals belong to Jesus, who's keeping them on ice until marriage. The whole speech was delivered with the energy of someone trying to sell me a timeshare behind an Exxon. It might shock you to find out that purity rings are not a tradition going back to the Mayflower. Christian abstinence groups handed them out like candy in the 90s, and the Trays of Young Life were happy to keep the tradition going so young women could non-verbally announce to the world, "My pussy belongs to the Lord." Abstinence education in any form is astronomically ineffective. Only 3% of the population waits to have sex until they're married. The University of Massachusetts Amherst found a whopping 30% of female teenage abstinence pledge takers and then breakers got pregnant, compared to 18% of regular old sexually active teenagers. And of course they did. They couldn't stop their horny zombie bodies. And with no accurate knowledge about safe, protected sex, they weren't aware of what could happen if their dude sprayed them down inside like a renegade garden hose. If Killjoy adults really wanted teens to stop having sex, they'd teach them how to masturbate. What they're doing isn't just about preventing intercourse. It's about control and deceit, and women bear the brunt of these malicious tactics. According to a Harvard report on abstinence education titled Sex, Lies, and Stereotypes, How Abstinence-Only Programs Harm Women and Girls. Young women are emotionally harmed by the idea that they are responsible for male sexuality. They also found women of color are more likely to get STDs from unprotected sex, and that abstinence programs exacerbate racial inequality by propelling stereotypes that black women are more sexually aggressive than white women, and reinforcing traditional gender roles for Latinas. Abstinence education is a human rights issue for women and is a terrible amount of pressure and shame to put on an experience that means fuck all. I lost my virginity to a guy named Bubba, and yeah, okay, go ahead and judge, but it's not what you think. He wasn't some rotten-toothed exterminator in an American flag tank top driving around in a jacked-up extended cab pickup with balls hanging from the trailer hitch. No, Bubba was, improbably, an all-star football player with the body of Chris Evans, the smile of Idris Elba, and the brain of a fifth grader. And that last part is why he fucked me. I'd been running a failed campaign my junior year to lose my virginity. The plan was to throw myself desperately at guys out of my league and see if anyone would take the bait. Hardcore flirting, getting detention for wearing butt crescent revealing skirts to school, hanging on every word of a basketball player and laughing at his sentences even when they weren't jokes. You're so funny, Zach. For the late 90s, I was rocking a good look. Overplucked eyebrows, old bowling shirts paired with short skirts, Doc Martens and brown lipstick. But once I opened my mouth, the secret was out. I was annoying! My sophomore year, I got kicked out of an Olive Garden for running around without shoes on, screaming and doing a joke where my bottom lip didn't work so water would pour down my dress. A year may have passed, but that person, too classless for a restaurant chain that smells like a prison kitchen on meatball day, was still alive and well inside me. Even the horniest of teens didn't want the emotional mess that was 5'11" me begging to be fucked. And then Ding Dong Hottie came to Houston for the summer. Bubba used to go to our junior high, but moved back to Louisiana and was in Houston staying with his friend Robbie. My sister was dating Robbie, and so I was around, and I guess Bubba liked how I hung on his every stupid word. I was new to him, which was good. He hadn't become absolutely unable to tolerate the sound of my voice. One hot Houston summer night, Bubba took my virginity on the low-pile beige carpeting of my sister's bedroom. I'm sorry, Audrey. I want you to know I did vacuum afterwards. Bubba was not a virgin, so I assumed he would know what he was doing, which was presumptuous. He didn't have a condom, so I gave him one. A hot pink, old, probably defective condom I got in the bathroom of a tattoo parlor. After receiving my very first fake ID, I paid someone to tattoo terrible tribal art on my ankle with the money I was supposed to use to pay for a speeding ticket. After the tattoo, I rewarded myself for being brave by buying a condom in the ladies' room and telling myself I would put this on a special dick soon and have the night of my life. It was a night, all right. And I experienced it while alive, but I wouldn't categorize it as the night of my life. Bubba jammed his rubber-covered dick into my dry vagina, and we sandpaper fucked until he was done. I couldn't believe people had fun doing this. I mean, I'll admit, dry, awkward sex was better than an orgasm from rocking my Levi's 501 crotch seam back and forth against a beanbag chair, but not by much. Losing my virginity was like being promised my whole life that one special day, I'd eat the best pizza in all of Italy. And then, when the special day arrived, I was handed an overcooked pepperoni hot pocket. First times are always disappointing, which is why people need to practice. So let's save the $75 billion we put into abstinence education each year and give teens reversible vasectomies, a warehouse full of condoms, a full understanding of consent, and then set them free to go to town on each other's perfect bodies, God filled with gallons of hormones. to suck and lick and fuck and experiment with whoever they want and make mistakes and get better. So by the time they're in their 20s, everyone's all like really good at sex, and there won't be Hunger Games style fights between girlfriends over Carlos on our improv team because we heard he fucks like a champion. Chapter 13. Doctors are not the boss of you! Picture this. 2003. Houston is in the throes of a classic Gulf of Mexico Thanksgiving. The trees are dead, the rain is relentless, and all of my worst high school friends are spending their nights at Pennison's Sports Pub as a joke, doing peppermint schnapp shots and talking about the good old days, which were only 6 years ago. I'm home from Chicago, where I've been living on my own far away from Houston for the first time since college. I've traded in Coldplay for the Shins, Dave Matthews for the Strokes. I'm different, and I don't care to be around a bunch of people who will make fun of me for having a better haircut and reading books for fun. I'm in the looking for Mr. Goodbar portion of my 20s, full of independence and stupidity, trading the familiarity of friends for the company of strangers. I was at a dive bar in Montrose, the cool part of Houston, by myself, reading Spalding Gray's Swimming to Cambodia, purposefully holding up the cover to see if anyone at the snake pit was buying my newly acquired sophistication. Oh, look at her, a young hottie in a little boy's old navy flannel shirt, reading a book and drinking wine. Her arms are more muscular than most women's, but I like that. She looks like the kind of woman who thinks It's a Wonderful Life is overrated. I hope it's true, he would think. He being Declan, who rolls his tattered copy of Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason into the back pocket of his perfectly fitted 1970s Levi's. He grabs his whiskey and adjusts his semi-wrinkled blue Oxford shirt and walks towards me. What are two people like us doing in such a dumpster fire of a city? He'd ask. Then we'd both respond, visiting. Oh my God, we'd laugh and laugh and laugh, and then we'd make love, like wild dogs, and it would never get old. I imagined our East Village apartment, littered with fiddle leaf figs and old records of bands who had long since been forgotten. Dinner parties of bone marrow and fresh brioche bread from the baker under our building. Our credit card bill would arrive and we'd laugh. We ever pay off the $65,000 we spent keeping up this lifestyle? Oh, God. Oh, we'd laugh some more, and then we'd do a bunch of drugs. Oh, God, we're fun together. Declan never came, but Farhad did. Interested in my childish attire and adultish reading habits, or just straight up horny, he chatted me up at the bar. Also visiting for the holiday, he was hanging out with a friend who promptly got lost after a half hour of standing behind us as we flirted. Farhad was very fit, very handsome, and very smart, and a head and neck surgeon, which blew me away. I can't imagine the amount of things one would have to know to even begin to understand the head. The neck sounds pretty easy. It's a spine and a tube and a couple of boxing bags hanging from the back of the throat. But still, if someone came to me with a neck problem, I wouldn't know where to start. All I knew was you had to be smart to be a doctor, and then double smart to be a specific kind of doctor. Looks like I hit the jackpot. After making out on bar stools at the snake pit like two drunk slobs, we rented a hotel room at the Doubletree, the only hotel for a hookup where you're guaranteed a warm cookie. We were naked, and I was about to mount him like a Clydesdale when he stopped me. Farhad explained to me that he was scared I might hurt his dick. Once, while a woman was riding him cowgirl, she bent his dick back with the entire weight of her torso. He was overly concerned I'd be wet enough to execute this routine flawlessly. At this point, I'd had 10 vodkas and a pack of American Spirit cigarettes. My body wasn't working like she should, and I didn't want to cause further injury to this poor doctor's penis. How could he go back to work saving head necks with a broken dick clanging around in his scrubs? I couldn't have that on my conscience. Thankfully, the good doctor came up with a medical solution. I should squirt hotel conditioner up my vagina. And I didn't even question it. He went to medical school. Surely there was an entire semester devoted to the safety of mixing panthenol, silicone, and humectants with the delicate pH balance of the most complicated organ on planet Earth. Now, hotel conditioner doesn't exit the bottle like home conditioner does. It doesn't delicately slide from the pump like a follicle-nourishing liquid silk. It plops out like old sour cream in tiny little globules of hair-softening goop. I violently ejected the thick substance from the miniature bottle and rubbed it inside my baby canal. Conditioner in the vagina feels exactly like you think it would, like a thin coating of heavily perfumed yogurt. I smeared the rest of the contents onto Farhad's semi-erect manhood and slip-slid it all up and down him, not injuring his dick in any way. For nearly a week, my insides rid itself of the foreign substance, spitting out little bits of conditioner into my panties. During this fight for cleanliness, my lady parts were attacked by a yeast infection more powerful than all the kombucha mothers in San Francisco combined. How could a doctor do this to me? There's a misconception about doctors. Just because a person has the guts to dissect a corpse for 11 billion hours does not automatically transform them into some sort of all-knowing super being who has the definitive answers to all human conditions. And sure, that's all okay if you're just hooking up with a doctor who convinces you to shove hair care products up your naughty bits, but what if you're in their office and you need actual medical advice? For about 7 years, I went to a very prominent gynecologist in Los Angeles. It was an accident that I even saw him in the first place. He has a gender-neutral first name, which I assumed meant a jaunty woman filled with a love of gardening and a deep devotion to medical well-being would enter the exam room. It's important to be comfortable with your gynecologist because it's a very intimate doctor's visit. For those of you listening to this book who have never had a well woman's exam, let me explain what happens. First, we get completely nude. Then we slip on a paper bolero jacket, our breasts exposed, but our shoulder and back completely covered. You know, so we feel comfortable. The frosty air conditioning blows across our bare breasts, creating tiny little icicles that hang from our nipples. Nipsicles, if you will. Then we unfold a paper blanket so thin it makes an airplane throw look like a luxury goose down comforter and drape it over our legs and pelvis. We sit in our paper towel shroud for 45 minutes to 2 hours, reading a 2016 People magazine. Are Miley Cyrus and Liam Hemsworth engaged? Then our doctor walks in. For those of us who've not been pregnant, a gynecologist is essentially a stranger who we see once a year for 20 minutes. There are no apologies for their lateness. You scoot your butt down to the edge of the table and put your legs into two little Tiny Tim leg braces. Then the doctor unceremoniously shoves a cold, wet, metal caulking gun into your vagina like it's no big deal. A Q-tip the size of a baseball bat is inserted and rubbed on your cervix and then sent to the lab for tests. They release the metal opener, but it's not over! They put one entire hand inside your vagina and then the other on your stomach and press them together to see if they can touch, because that's apparently the best way to investigate a uterus in the 21st century. The whole thing ends with a breast exam, sometimes a rectal exam, and then it's 364 days until the fun starts again. I don't have anything personal against straight male gynecologists, other than I find their career choice suspect as fuck. I'm sure there's like 4 sexless guys in obstetrics and gynecology, but I've had several boyfriends who couldn't go to yoga class because they would get erections from seeing the outline of women's coochies in Down Dog. So I'm thinking it's entirely possible a lot of these dudes are in the vagina biz for weird reasons. Do you remember what Cliff Huxtable's job was on The Cosby Show? He had an OBGYN practice in his home basement. Yes, he was a basement gynecologist. Now, I'm a polite southerner whose first instinct is to always spare other people's feelings over my own comfort. So instead of leaving when I saw this Stephen Colbert Bob Saget face mash enter the room, I let this man examine me. Things were fine with Dr. Keeping That Gender Vague for 3 or so years. Then in 2010, I'm using my paper gown hour to work on a book proposal. A comedic essay book about sex I did not sell because I was 100 years late to that game. In he bursts, no apologies, and sees my laptop, piquing his interest. I know by his waiting room he's pulling in real Hollywood B-listers, so I'm not shocked at how nosy he is about my work. When I tell him what I'm writing, he asks,
"Am I in it?"
"Why would you be in it?" I asked, confused. "Why would I talk about my gynecologist in a book about all the losers I fucked?" The nurse practitioner who chaperones him during visits didn't react, and I let it go. I only saw this guy once a year, so I could deal with this in small doses. Plus, finding a new gynecologist is like trying to catch a friend up on a show they've never seen during the season finale. I just don't have the time. The next year, he tried to talk me out of the preventative mastectomy I talked about earlier. His office had a giant photorealistic oil painting of a baby being pulled out of a woman via C-section. The artist had drawn a spotlight around this kid who was terrified and covered in pregnancy slime. And the doctor had framed the monstrosity with the kind of ornate woodwork you'd find around Raphael's Sistine Madonna. I stared at it. "You know I don't want to have children, right? I've mentioned it several times," I added.
"Women always change their minds."
This is the kind of stuff you write for a villain to say, so later, when he's hanging off a cliff, you can watch the heroine stomp on his fingers with her heels and feel that justice has been served. And yes, I did make an appointment that day for a follow-up in a year. In addition to the yearly pap, I wanted to get an IUD. My friend loved hers, and I was dating my now husband, who I was having lots of sex with but didn't quite know if we were going to work out. Our decorating styles are wildly different, and he didn't use a calendar then, so I wasn't sure I could count on him to show up on the right day of an abortion. I made an appointment with Dr. Can't Believe You're Still Seeing Me to have him shove a skinny, upside-down, baby-preventing anchor into my uterus. When he inserted it, he accidentally punched it into the top of my uterus. Imagine the pain of 1,000 jellyfish concentrated into one area deep inside the most sensitive part of your body. Then magnify that agony by 1,000 and you'll sort of understand what kind of distress I was in. The misery was so intense, my brain did everyone a favor and passed me out. When I woke up, I could barely walk. My balance was off and I was sick from the pain. Dr. Uterus Punch apologized and ran out of the room like a coward, leaving me with the nurse practitioner, who was sympathetic, but offered me no explanations about what the fuck was happening. All she knew was most people don't react like this. When I stopped passing out, I was allowed to drive myself home, sitting in an upright car seat, compressing the part of my body that had just been traumatized. I crawled into bed, and I cried. For dinner, I ordered in Indian food from a new place, and it was not good, topping off an F-minus day with a runny masala. It took me 2 days to recover, but I still wasn't fully back to normal. Every time I sat in a chair, that tiny little contraption jabbed me, reminding me it's still there and still pointy. After a month of a living nightmare, I went in to have the stupid thing removed.
"Are you sure you want it out? Sometimes it takes a couple months to settle in."
"Doctor, women don't know anything," asked me, after I had listed all the reasons it was not welcome inside me. "Take it out today!" He got scared because I was mad. It took me years to get slightly angry with this motherfucker, and on this day, he would do something that would push my experience with anger into a whole new horizon. The nurse practitioner, who, let's be honest, always does the real work, put me in a robe and stuck my feet into the stirrups while the doctor grabbed a removal tool. It resembled metal tongs, the kind you lower corn into boiling water with, only thinner and 3 times as long. I saw his head disappear under the horizon line created by the paper sheet draped between my 2 legs. I could sort of feel what was going on inside me, but it was too vague to make out exactly what was happening. The internal movement stopped. From below my paper gown, an IUD covered in blood and uterus ooze appeared. And then I heard, in a high-pitched cartoon voice, this.
"I'm out! I came out!
It was the puppet show no one asked for, voiced by a medical professional hiding underneath my throwaway garment, his face inches away from my pussy, smiling and having a great time. I mean, he had to hide his face. It was necessary. Otherwise, it would have destroyed the illusion the IUD was alive. When he realized I didn't appreciate his brand of theater, he popped his head over my open legs and smiled, "All better." With that, they both left the room, without even a curtain call. Wherever would I throw my roses? I lay there for, I don't know, 6 years, and thought about what just happened. There was only one way to handle this. I immediately marched out of there and confronted him. Did he think because I'm in the comedy business, I enjoy jokes when I'm in a vulnerable situation at the doctor's, nude with my legs wide open? I don't care how many celebrity babies he's plucked out of This Is Us co-stars, I won't be treated so casually. This might be Hollywood Buster, number one enemy of women, but I demand in this office I am treated with dignity and respect. Just kidding, I said nothing and saw him for another 2 years. While I was telling someone my hilarious Dr. Carrot Top prop comedian OB Jokes YN story, my friend Rachel, who cares about me and is so tired of this story, even though it kills at parties, begged me to have some self-respect and switch to her doctor. And I did. In early 2016, I went in to see her gay, male OBGYN, who told me he didn't think a woman should be president until after she's been through menopause. You know, 'cause of all the hormones. Oh boy, he picked the perfect time to tell me as he was checking my ovaries from the inside of my butthole. This guy was a step up for me. These are all doctors who are trained by schools for a long time to deal specifically with women, and they can't even do that right. So it stands to reason, if the medical experts who are supposed to know everything about women are failing, medical non-experts are probably committing untold atrocities. Even though for years doctors studied the physiological ways men and women are different, we are treated medically as if we're the same. Textbooks are partly to blame. According to the study Sexism in Anatomy, published in the Journal of Anatomy, many medical textbooks lack illustrations of the female body, which means med students can't even find the clitoris. Am I right? I understand the female system is way more complicated and there's more to learn about, but so what? It's medical school. If you want an easy degree, study fashion merchandising like I did. I spent nearly an entire semester in the Houston Galleria critiquing Gucci window displays and memorizing different kinds of light bulbs. Sometimes I would drink margaritas and eat Southwestern egg rolls at the Cheesecake Factory and watch people learn to ice skate and then, in 10 minutes, finish my lessons drunk. It's also hard to find good data on how medicine affects women because we've only been allowed to participate in clinical trials since 1993, when the FDA decided it might be important to find out how drugs affect us differently. But even with the FDA's permission, we're still left out of a lot of research because of our period. The complexities of the menstrual cycle are considered major barriers to the inclusion of women in clinical trials, argue the researchers behind a 2016 editorial published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. The complexities of the menstrual cycle are barriers to many things. Wearing white pants with confidence, entering Balinese temples, sex without a towel. And now, medical studies. Here's why it's important to test medicine on people with different physiological components, because of what happened with Ambien. We've all heard about some of the crazy shit people do while in an Ambien sleep trance. My friend Caroline, who's in her mid-20s, will wake up the morning after Ambien to find an email confirming her order of some home shopping nonsense purchase of like 7 bottles of Carol's Daughter hair milk she has no recollection of buying. Ambien turns my friend Caroline into a bored 68-year-old woman recovering from hip surgery. Hallucinations, sleep driving, which is dangerous and sometimes deadly, and sending emails that just read, are all side effects of Ambien. But Japanese researchers have noted women were more likely to suffer from these severe side effects compared to men. The FDA didn't pay attention to their study until Kai Falkenberg wrote about the phenomenon in Marie Claire in 2013. Then another study was released by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, reporting women accounted for 2/3 of the Ambien-related emergency room visits. After all that, the FDA finally lowered the dosage recommendation for women. Women are also twice as likely to have bad reactions to medicine, and we're affected differently by a whole slew of psychotropic medications. We're less likely to be properly treated for fibromyalgia, which is basically a lady disease. And this is a big one here. Women are more likely to be misdiagnosed when we're having a heart attack because we often experience symptoms other than chest pain, like shortness of breath, cold sweats, and jaw pain, which is exactly how I feel after a premenstrual In-N-Out French fry bender. Seems like it would be easy enough for doctors to update the Rolodex of symptoms they carry around in their brains, but the stereotype of a man grabbing his chest while he falls to the ground is difficult to, you know, kill. Of course, all this medical negligence is worse if you're a black woman. The United States already has a high maternal mortality rate, very high for a developed country, and one of the reasons is that black mothers die at 3 to 4 times the rate of white mothers, according to a report by NPR. The institutionalized sexism in the medical profession puts on a racism hat and does a little dance before it treats black women. All women suffer from their pain not being taken seriously by doctors, but black women more so. Black and Hispanic patients across the board are less likely to receive adequate treatment for their pain. Even Serena Williams goes through this shit. In a 2017 Vogue interview, she spoke about how she's prone to blood clots and how, after she gave birth, she was having trouble breathing and assumed she was experiencing a clot in her lungs. She told a nurse what was happening, but this fucking nurse suggested to Williams that her pain medication must be making her confused. Williams eventually received the CT scan she requested, and it confirmed she wasn't making it up. Because of course she wasn't. Serena knows her body. She shouldn't have to harangue a team of medical staff to pay attention to her just because she's a black woman. Get it together, medical industry! Considering how to treat a woman's health shouldn't be an afterthought. And for my lady patient friends, start treating your doctors like your Trump-supporting Facebook headline-skimming aunt. Make them explain what they're saying to you. Make them cite their sources. Make them communicate. Explain that Hillary was cleared of any wrongdoing multiple times. Be the exhausting bitch who is out there advocating for your health, and when you don't like the answers, their attitude, and the way they're treating you, pull out your phone in front of them, press your home button, and say, Siri, call the state medical board complaint hotline, and as you wait on hold, look the doctor straight in the eyes and say, I didn't take no Hippocratic oath to first do no harm. Chapter 14, Turning That STD Upside Down. There's a cool club you may or may not be a part of. It's a fundraiser for all the fucking raddest chicks in the world. The party is called Genital Herpes, and if you're not one of the 26 million U.S. women who have it, where you at, sister? Your STDs are waiting for you. If your pussy is cleaner than Clorox Cleanup, let me tell you how to get totally invaded by the most popular STD, like, ever. Getting herpes is not easy. It took me years. You can't just rub your punani on an uncovered Penn Station toilet seat. You have to train and be methodical if you want to do it right. The first thing you have to do is be absolutely stupid. If you were homeschooled by evangelical parents, congratulations! You are way ahead of the game! Not that American public schools are cranking out sex ed experts. My high school sex ed class was taught by a baseball coach who stammered out anatomical terms like vagina and penis. Sweat dripping down his forehead like he'd just seen the ghost of a Civil War soldier floating through the classroom. I'm just saying, if the man had been having a stroke in front of us, no one would have noticed the difference. My parents didn't tell me anything either. The only person who was there to help us kids understand our biscuits and sausages was Devin Taylor's older gay brother. He gave us a copy of Kids, a deranged movie about New York City teens who fuck and do drugs and give each other HIV. We'd rotate houses for regular viewing parties, and a room full of teenagers would suddenly go quiet, watching, slack-jawed, as these misfits use sex as a tool of anarchy. Kids is totally insane and broke every child indecency law in America, but we finally had some answers. We found out where we could go get tested for STDs, what reckless barebacking looked like, that slut-shaming hurts, and how people without legs ride skateboards. Learning I could get AIDS from one sexual encounter, then give it to a guy who is raping me while I'm passed out on drugs at a house party, was valuable information for me and my sexually active friends. Do you think I kept fucking my boyfriend condomless in the bathroom at house parties? Ho 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 ho! Not after Kids, I didn't. But my education was limited to what was covered in that movie. If Larry Clark didn't shoot it, I didn't know it. Which meant I still didn't know a lot. In college, I learned nothing new about STDs, but I did learn, even in college, no one wanted to fuck me. So I kept fucking Bubba, the guy to whom I lost my virginity. I would drive 6 hours to New Orleans to have sex with him, only to have him ditch me in the middle of Bourbon Street for hours, while he ran off and got drunk with his friends and laughed at trans strippers. Dude was a complete goon! Eventually, I stopped wasting my gas money driving to another state for sex with that lunkhead. Oh my God, that whole time, from college until my marriage at 25, was awful. How could I learn about sexual health and safety? I was deeply depressed about whether or not I could actually date someone I liked in Texas. I was a young, liberal, loud woman with a deep love of silly jokes and an overactive sense of righteousness, trying to date in a state full of guys in Tommy Hilfiger shirts and Red Wing boots who liked their women quiet and agreeable. Then at 24, I met my first husband through a friend who used to live in LA. He's Jewish, smart, in the entertainment industry, and super fit, and nothing like any of the guys I had ever met. We got married 2 months after we met and after we both had STD tests that came back negative, so I didn't have to keep learning about that shit. I was out of the system. When we got divorced, even though it was the right thing, I fell into a deep depression. The only things I had an appetite for were plain chicken breasts and cigarettes, transforming my body into a lithe, sexy skeleton. Before I was ready, I got back in the dating cesspool to look for some new dick to dock. This was pre-Tinder, so it was on to OkCupid, where I, elbow model, searched for people to fill my emotional and physical hole. The grad student studying architecture at UCLA, the coder with two earrings in each lobe, the writer, the other writer, a third writer. None of them gave me herpes. Then I met Crunlap von Swingleton in an acting class. Crunlap was a very, very impossibly good-looking professional stand-up, a unicorn in the comedy world. Be truly honest with yourself when you think you're attracted to a male comic. Remove the stage and the jokes. If you saw an unevenly shaved dude eating a burrito from the inside out at 3 a.m., like a crow chowing down on a squirrel carcass in between intermittent cocaine phlegm collections, you would absolutely run in the other direction. Crunlap flirted with me in class, and I flirted back. We got to know each other through cold readings and after-class hangouts. When I found out he paid out of pocket to have his teeth cleaned 3 times a year, I soaked my chair. Most male stand-ups are real slutbags, and Crunlap was no different. Fucking women in Tucson and Buffalo, doing blow with his opener in San Diego, then banging whatever low-hanging fruit was misguided enough to believe a night in a sperm-crusted hotel room paid for by the Laugh Shack was gonna change your life. Crunlap possessed a potent Catholic people-pleasing drive and a borderline homicidal sexual appetite, making him the perfect fuck machine. One night I was sitting on his face, wishing I could freeze time and stay there forever. Was there a way to put his face on an ergonomic office chair? Could I market it as the Crunlap Cunnilingus Herman Miller chair? Little did I know, as I contacted imaginary venture capitalists in my head, that my herpes club card was on its way. A couple of days later, I was shooting a commercial when I was struck with genital pain I can only describe as 1,000 thumbelinas starting campfires on my labia. In the bathroom, I discovered the horror in my panties. My skin had ripped open in a popped blister kind of way, making the most sensitive parts of my body burn with agony. It looked like my labia were a butterfly emerging from a skin cocoon, but replace butterfly with exposed, raw, infected vagina flesh. Not something you want landing on your children's nose in a natural history pavilion. I couldn't leave the shoot. There's no emergencies in acting when you only make money 4 times a year. So I suffered through what I thought was a staph infection from waxing by running to the bathroom every time someone called cut, sitting on an industrial toilet and pouring Arrowhead water down my jellyfish-stained cooter. Then I dried off and went back to set and did my job like Judy fucking Garland would have. We wrapped at 6 p.m. and it was a Friday, so my gyno was already on his way home in his fancy car to practice his IUD cartoon voices. As bad as my gyno was, he was nothing compared to the dumbass doctor I saw at the ER at Cedars-Sinai. He was looking at my vagina as if damaged human parts weren't his expertise. This guy had no idea, after all those years in medical school, that I was suffering from the most common STD in America. Here's how I know he didn't know. If he did know those lesions were herpes and very painful, he wouldn't have given me a pelvic exam like a fucking masochist. Was I at a hospital or inside Dick Cheney's Guantanamo wet dream? Dr. Garbage Brains proceeded to pull out a speculum, which is not the tool of choice for someone whose clam chops look like they've been fingered by Edward Scissorhands. It's normally uncomfortable, but opening the speculum also tore open the exposed, bright red finger lakes decorating my salami garage. I have a high threshold for pain, but this made me pass out. Dr. Demented sent me home with amoxicillin and a pat on the shoulder. I'm just glad I got out of there before he put a potato sack over my head and waterboarded me. The only way I got through the weekend was thanks to my responsible prescription drug addict friends. They drop off tiny Ziploc bags of the stuff at my doorstep, and I would crack open my front door, extend my claw, and pull the random pills inside. Then I would slide into a saltwater bath like a salamander and stay there until Monday when my gyno could finally see me. Turns out the only time my gynecologist is serious is when there's an actual medical problem. He didn't even have any jokes like, "Ouch, what'd you do, sit on a table saw?" Or, "Looks like someone needs some Blisterine." Instead, he put on his human being face and broke the news to me that I probably had herpes. "It's not possible. We always wear a condom," I yelled. Then I cried. I cried so hard. He explained condoms don't protect against herpes. Even though Crunlap, the sex addict comedian, always wore a condom, turns out his teeth cleanings weren't keeping his mouth that clean. According to medical science, that's apparently only taught to 3 doctors and no non-doctors, if you rub your fuck-torn goop shoot on the face of a guy who had chicken pox as a kid and who now gets cold sores on his adult mouth, then congratulations, you have herpes! There are so many other ways to get herpes. This was just the method that was easiest for me. Feel free to adjust according to what method works for you. Fucking a 5-time divorced Major League Baseball player bareback. Letting any member of a Coldplay cover band go down on you. Rimming a comic book store owner with a ponytail and a crustache. You get it. So now you've got herpes. Welcome to the Valtrex jungle, baby. But what do you do now with your newfound sores, besides brag? At first, you're going to want to spit in your Crunlap's face after screaming, "You selfish pile of elephant diarrhea!" while in the middle of Sycamore Kitchen, interrupting everyone's morning avocado toast. And that's fine. Get it out of your system. It's going to be hard to do when he tells you he might have done this to a previous girlfriend who he thinks was also misdiagnosed by an emergency room in Los Angeles, and hearing you explain the situation, he can clearly see that probably was the case, and so now you find yourself on a call with a person you are furious at, while also begging him to immediately call his ex-girlfriend so he can break the news to her that she has herpes. Then order your scrambled eggs with chorizo, hide in the corner where no one will notice if you're crying, and focus on what it means to now be